This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, we'll get an update on the lame duck session of the Michigan legislature from Gongwer News Service editor Zach Gorchow. But first, Western Michigan University professor of comparative religion Brian Wilson has written a new book about John Harvey Kellogg. Here he reads a passage from John Harvey Kellogg and the Religion of Biologic Living.
So in the summer of 1940, at the age of 88, Dr. John Harvey Kellogg, seeking to record on paper some of the essential facts of his long life, cast his thoughts back to 1863, a time when Battle Creek, Michigan was a very small village of a few hundred inhabitants, and the great Battle Creek Sanitarium was still many years in the future. His mother, Kellogg remembered, had just asked the young boy what he wanted to do when he grew up, to which he promptly replied, "Anything but a doctor."
WMUK's Zinta Astars spoke with Western Michigan University professor Brian Wilson.
Welcome, Brian. Let's begin with what drew you to writing this book. Originally, you were going to write simply about Battle Creek history?
That's correct. Yeah, I became fascinated with the religious history of Battle Creek. I came to Western in 1996 to take a job in the comparative religion department and decided that I would do a local research project. Part of it was just convenience, and part of it was coming from California, I had all sorts of kind of misconceptions about the cultural history of the Midwest, which I'm happy to say turned out to be completely wrong. And this was one way of kind of getting into the local community.
Okay.
But Battle Creek turned out to be fascinating because it was, in the 19th century, a small community for a variety of reasons that attracted all sorts of interesting new religious groups for the time. So there were Quakers, and they were Hicksite Quakers, so they're very liberal Quakers. Mm-hmm. There were Universalists, people who didn't believe in the reality of hell. There were Swedenborgians who followed the mystical teachings of the Swedish seer Emanuel Swedenborg. There are also freethinkers and deists, and all these people basically got along in Battle Creek. And at a certain point, a number of the Quakers became very interested in spiritualism, the idea that you can contact the spirits of the dead through the ritual of the seance. Mm. And this became, of course, a national craze after 1848. But it especially became fascinating for the Quakers, especially the Hicksite Quakers, the liberal Quakers. Mm-hmm. And so they basically converted en masse into spiritualists and created the first independent church, which was a spiritualist church, which thrived for years in Battle Creek. So Battle Creek, beginning in the late 40s, early 50s of the 19th century, had become a kind of mecca for kind of unconventional religiosity. So that was one of the things that really drew me to Battle Creek.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing about Battle Creek is you can't ignore the fact that it becomes the headquarters for the Seventh-day Adventist Church.
And yeah, I hadn't realized that part, that, you know, we all probably think of Battle Creek as a serial city, and that is a part of this story. But your story about the other brother actually has a lot to do with, as you're saying, religion, the Seventh-day Adventists. So tell us a little more about that.
Yeah, the Seventh-day Adventists descend from a movement called Millerism, which popped up in the Northeast in the 1820s and 1830s. And William Miller believed he'd kind of cracked the biblical code and could predict roughly the date of the end of the world, when the second coming would occur. And he convinced a lot of people with his logic that this was true. And so a lot of people kind of broke away from their existing churches and began to follow William Miller. Well, when the predicted date didn't occur, another date was set, and tensions were kind of ratcheted up after that. And finally, they decided it was going to be October 22nd, 1844. That was going to be the date. Mm. Well, that rolled around too, and of course, nothing happened. And the vast majority of Miller's followers essentially fell away. They lost confidence in him. And William Miller himself went back to his farm and retired, and that's pretty much the last we heard of him. But there are a number of people who believed something had happened on that date. Hmm. It just didn't happen on earth, it happened in heaven. And so they developed this notion that Jesus in heaven, in the heavenly temple, had begun a process of cleansing the heavenly temple And when he was finished with this process, then he would return for the second coming on earth. So he was coming. It's going to be soon. And October 22nd, 1844 marked an important date, mm-hmm. The beginning of this process, but it's only the beginning, not the end. So people who were willing to accept this idea came to call themselves Adventists. Advent just simply meaning arrival. Mm-hmm. And among those Adventists, there were some who decided that they were going to adopt the Saturday Sabbath. So instead of celebrating the Sabbath on Sunday, they would go back to the old Jewish Sabbath of Saturday. And that's why they're called the Seventh Day Adventist.
And I remember in reading the book that there was even something in there about how his parents, the child when he was small, didn't have him learn how to read because they thought, well, what's the point?
In the early days, there was a high degree of expectation that the second coming was going to occur soon.
Yeah.
And so this always creates tensions because how far do you have to go to, you know, maintain your normal life if everything's going to get disrupted very quickly? And this is one of the stories that's told about Kellogg, that Kellogg's father thought, why bother sending my kid to school if the second coming is around the corner? Well, the movement, the Seventh-day Adventist movement, began evolving, and they did start to begin to create institutional structures for the long haul and basically pushing back their expectations of the end a little bit farther away than they normally thought. And so education became a part of that. And luckily for John Harvey Kellogg, he did have some rudimentary elementary education, learned to read and write. And he himself was an autodidact. He just loved reading and learning.
So the history of Battle Creek doesn't begin with cereal. It begins with this sanitarium that Kellogg built and with this concept of biologic living. Explain to us what biologic living is.
Well, biologic living is the idea that just as God had created a series of moral laws to help us live in this life and to help us achieve salvation, the Ten Commandments, obviously, he also created a series of physical laws of the universe, laws that basically impact our bodies, and that we are obliged to follow the physical laws of health just like we're following the moral laws of the Ten Commandments. So in a lot of cases, Kellogg would refer to the greater Ten Commandments, and that included biologic living. And biologic living was this idea that you not only could live a moral life, but you also had to live physically a life that would essentially lead to what he called physiological righteousness.
Mm.
And in time, he came to believe that purity of body was just as important as purity of soul for one's ultimate salvation. And that's the key to biological living.
So he saw the possibility of a perfect human being. Is that right? What was perfection to him? Well, I guess both on the religion side and the physical side. What did he see as the perfect human being?
Well, he did believe that God essentially had given human beings the resources to achieve perfection in this life, both spiritually and physically. Now, there had been a long strain of spiritual perfectionism in this country, and it starts with Charles Grandison Finney back in the early 19th century. So this wasn't a new idea, but Kellogg's idea that married to this concept, you could also have a perfect body, this was something new. And in fact, it was troubling to the leadership within the Seventh-day Adventist Church, because the leader of the church, the prophetess, Ellen G. White, always made it very clear that one should strive for bodily health, but perfection would never be achieved in this life.
Mm.
And it would not, that in itself would not impact one's salvation.
His philosophy, his religion clashed often. Is that more his philosophy, or perhaps it was his personality? He seems to be a powerful personality. And in fact, at the end of the story, he is excommunicated from the church?
Yes, they call it disfellowshipping.
Okay.
And in 1907, the church, it was pretty much by mutual agreement. Kellogg and his brother, Will K. Kellogg, both were struck from the roles of the Battle Creek Church. And the issues involved are pretty complex. Part of its ego, John Harvey Kellogg has a tremendous ego and a tremendous sense of ambition and a tremendous sense of his own destiny. He's one of these people who really feels he has his own destiny. And he goes up against Ellen G. White, who, for her part, also has a tremendous sense of her own destiny. And in the beginning, they work together. But over time, of course, you have two charismatic persons within the church, and this becomes a point of friction. So there was that. Kellogg really wanted the Seventh-day Adventist Church to really focus completely on what he called medical missionary work. And he wanted the Seventh-day Adventist Church to pretty well downplay the kind of distinctive doctrinal things that made Seventh-day Adventism a sectarian movement and adopt primarily medicine as their way of proselytizing people. Ellen White, on the other hand, thought that this showed a lack of balance. The medical work was important, but the preaching the word of the end was even more important. So you had these kind of theological kinds of tensions between them. And then theologically, Kellogg always was concerned with reconciling his Seventh-day Adventism. He'd been brought up in it, in the heart of Seventh-day Adventism. Mm-hmm. He wanted to reconcile that with the kind of modern directions that science and medicine were going in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. So he was always torn. How much of his Adventism does he keep? How much does the kind of modern world impinge on his new worldview? And he worked very hard to come up with some kind of workable synthesis between the two. Mm. And in part, this entailed Seventh-day Adventist belief in a very concrete anthropomorphic God, a very concrete anthropomorphic Jesus, and they believe in a very concrete anthropomorphic life in heaven after death. For Kellogg, his vision of God was not anthropomorphic, but a personal God, but a God that basically pervaded the entire world. And in fact, God undergirded all the processes in the world, physical, biological, moral. He was always there. His power was always kind of undergirding everything that was going on. So he talked about God being the servant of man.
Interesting concept.
His ubiquity everywhere and basically holding up the fabric of the universe. And of course, those kinds of comments about God being the servant of man offended people like Ellen White, who wanted to protect the sovereignty and dignity of God.
Paint a picture in words for us of the sanitarium. This was quite an immense operation that he had. Not only the building, but didn't he have something like 400 acres where he grew this fresh food that
yes.
people ate? And so tell us what this place is like and what do we find today?
Oh, it would have been remarkable if we could kind of time travel back. It was the core of the building was a huge Victorian pile, and it was this wood building with brick veneer, so it looked very substantial. Subsequent events would show it wasn't, but and it was huge, and it housed hundreds of people. It had special rooms for hydropathy, for the water cure, special rooms for gymnastic exercises, special rooms for heating treatments, for light treatments. In the back, there were tennis courts and sandboxes for kids to play in. Kellogg was a big believer in exposure to full-spectrum light. There were also interesting amenities. There was a palm garden in the middle of it, which people would go and basically they wouldn't have high tea because there was no tea there, but they would have a tea substitute and essentially listen to a string quartet play for a while. There were dances occasionally. It had kind of the atmosphere of a kind of posh European hotel.
Quite a resort.
Almost,
yeah.
Well, yes, and in fact, you not only had the outbuildings and the farmlands that were used to actually produce the food to supply the kitchens, but they even had cabins on Goguak Lake, which is a little lake right outside of Battle Creek, a little bit more rural, so if you got tired of being in the hospital, tired of being at, you know, in Battle
at the
Creek,
resort.
You could go off and be in the woods for a while in a nice little rented cabin and basically fish and row a canoe and just have a fun day. Yeah.
So what is there today? Something quite different.
What happened was in 1902, the old Victorian building burned to the ground. And nobody really knows exactly why. Was it an accident? Was it arson? Nobody really knows. The lucky thing was only one person lost their life in the conflagration, and he basically ran back into the burning building to retrieve his life savings. Mm-hmm. So at that point, Ellen White and the Adventist Church decided, well, we don't want to rebuild in Battle Creek. We want to diversify and build smaller sanitaria around the country that'll be more cost effective than this big old thing. Well, Kellogg would have absolutely nothing to do with it. And within 14 months, he'd completely rebuilt newer, bigger, better, the new Battle Creek Sanitarium. And this was a thoroughly modern, thoroughly fireproof building that had even, you know, greater amenities than the original had. Wow. And that building still survives. In 1929, they added on the Twin Towers, of substantial addition, which unfortunately opened its doors in 1929 just for the stock market crash. And so at that point, the sanitarium began to have real financial problems, and that's kind of the decline of it. But what happened was this main building complex was sold lock, stock, and barrel to the federal government, which then used it as a army hospital during World War II. And you get famous people like Bob Dole and Daniel Inouye as patients, spending a lot of time in the Federal Center. Well, the Army Hospital as it was then, the Percy Army Hospital. And then later on, as use changes, a number of different government branches have occupied the building, such that today it's a logistical center for Homeland Security.
Thank you. We've been talking with Brian C. Wilson about Dr. John Harvey Kellogg and the religion of biologic living.
Brian Wilson spoke with WMUK's Zinta A-Stars. He will speak at the Portage District Library on his new book, January 15th. More details can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Bills related to road funding and other issues remain before the Michigan legislature as its lame duck session continues. Gongwer News Service editor Zach Gorchow joins us for an update on what lawmakers may or may not accomplish before the end of the year. Zach, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Gordon.
Let's begin with road funding. As we talk on Friday morning, the House last night approved House Speaker Jace Bolger's plan, which phases out the sales tax on gasoline while bringing in a new gasoline tax or raising it. Does it seem like the House and Senate are going to be able to find common ground on some sort of a road funding package before they adjourn at the end of the year?
I think so. You know, I think the Senate passing that fairly substantial increase in the gasoline tax, combined with, you know, the governor's support for a move like that for some time, has put a lot of pressure on the House. Everything we hear is that the Speaker is a pretty solid supporter of increasing gasoline tax revenues. And what I think you saw yesterday with this plan that would lift the sales tax off of gasoline and essentially make it a revenue-neutral proposal, even with the gas tax going up, it was about a negotiating position, that the Speaker put the message privately to the other Republicans, if we don't pass this, the only alternative is the Senate plan to just raise the gasoline tax. You know, we have no leverage. So, you know, what a middle ground or some sort of compromise looks like at this point, I can't tell you. But it does seem to me that it's now moving toward the point where there will be some type of revenue increase for roads. There's just too much happening now to say that this is going to fall apart. You know, the Senate has gone way out on a limb now, and I can't see this falling apart at this stage, although you can never say never.
House Speaker Jace Bolger has talked about this being a way to fund roads without a tax increase. Does that provide some political cover, or at the end of the day, are people going to say $1 billion going to roads is coming from somewhere?
Well, I mean, yeah, it certainly, there's no question that, you know, if that plan were to become law, motorists would not see any change in what they're paying at the pump. So, yeah, it's definitely, you know, he can fairly say it is not a tax increase. you know, what the major criticism of the plan is that, you know, the sales tax on gasoline, just like the sales tax on everything else, largely funds K-12 public schools and local governments through revenue sharing. And, you know, if you take the sales tax away from off of gasoline, you're talking about $1 billion reduction in revenue, about $700 million of which goes towards schools that would need to be made up. Now, the forecast, the consensus economic forecast, and that's a nonpartisan forecast, for the state shows that sales tax revenues will continue to grow in the coming years, and that that would make up for this lost revenue. Now, even if you buy that, it would still mean then that K-12 schools essentially would be seeing, you know, no change in revenues. And just like anything else, you know, costs are increasing for everybody, whether that's in healthcare or wages or equipment and so forth. I don't think there's any question it would put schools in a difficult position. They're hoping to see some gains from the economy doing better like everybody else. So that's one issue. So the House put in some language last night that would say that the reduction or lifting of the sales tax off of gasoline would stop if there was actually a spending cut to K-12 schools or local governments. That's an interesting move. It would seem to buy some cover for those who voted for this last night to say, you know, that they were not cutting K-12 schools, which is certainly what Democrats will try to tag them with in subsequent campaigns. But the problem is that if that actually did come to pass, then you haven't really solved the road funding problem.
The governor identified road funding as one of the major priorities for the lame duck session. He also said that he wanted lawmakers to at least have a discussion on expanding the Elliott Larson Civil Rights Act and include protections against discrimination for sexual orientation. That has bogged down, apparently. How come it appears at this point that the legislature is going to adjourn without a vote on expanding Elliott Larson?
Well, it's a layered issue, a layered answer to that question. I mean, I think in the end, the major reason that it's not going to happen is there's still a reluctance in the legislature, Republican-controlled legislature, to go down this road. And I think the holdup seems to be that while there's been changes in thinking and more openness to the idea that people need to be protected from being fired or denied housing or denied access to a place, a public place, because they're gay or lesbian, it appears that that same change of thinking has not occurred regarding people who are transgender. And the Speaker of the House, Jace Bolger, is not willing to support a bill that extends those civil rights protections to transgender people. The supporters of the change are not willing to move forward with a bill that does not include transgender people. And there's sort of a difference in thinking among some of the supporters on this, that there is a faction, I think a minority faction within the LGBT community, that says, let's take what we can get. You know, we have to get protections at least for based on sexual orientation, which Jace Bolger, the Speaker, is willing to support. But, you know, and we'll have to leave the gender identity piece for another day. But it appears most of the activists out there that is not an acceptable solution, that they view that as throwing the transgender community under the bus, and that the transgender community actually is subject to the most discrimination in employment, housing, and access to public places, and so that they are in most need of those protections being extended to them, and that realistically, if you did move a bill that it did not include the transgender community, it could be a generation, at least, before you get back to that. So it's definitely a complicated, delicate situation. There's a lot of hard feelings about this right now. But I don't think there's any question at this point that the idea that the legislature is going to pass a change to Elliott Larson is dead. The other factor I didn't mention is that the Speaker wanted a separate statute enacted ensuring protections for religious freedom, so that essentially if someone were to refuse to participate in some way, whether their business being involved in a gay wedding, that they would not face sanctions under Elliot Larson under that, which still there hasn't been an answer to the question. You know, Elliot Larson only deals with employment, housing, and public accommodation. So it's still a little unclear to me exactly how the new religious freedom statute is supposed to fit with that, but that was something that the speaker wanted and the LGBT community was, vehemently opposed to.
But the religious freedom legislation did move ahead in the House, as did a bill regarding faith-based adoption agencies. In some ways, might the gay community be looking at what's happened in the legislature over these couple weeks and say, not only did we not get what we wanted, but in a way, we have felt our cause get set back somewhat?
Yes, is the answer to that question. I mean, I think, with the Elliot Larson stuff, I think part of the reason there's a lot of hard feelings is there was a sense for over a year that the Republicans were, leadership was going to work with them on the Elliot Larson stuff, that, Democrats held off introducing bills for a long, long time to make the change, sort of with the idea that, Republicans were going to work with them on this. And it's not so much that I guess you could say they feel like they've been taken to the altar and left there, because in the end, it's pretty clear the Republicans are not comfortable moving forward on this. And then, like you said, you have this Religious Freedom Restoration Act moving forward. Now, if it does become law, it's not going to just, involve potential issues with the LGBT community. It could involve a lot of things. And there is a national Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which was really not to get too far off the path here, but that was the key piece in why in the Hobby Lobby case that allowed closely held businesses to refuse to provide certain forms of birth control. So it's a much more overarching proposal than just gay issues.
Lame duck sessions often include bills that have sat for a while and then they all of a sudden come back up. And sometimes it can get very contentious. People remember Right to Work from a couple of years ago. Does there appear to be anything right now on the horizon which is going to lead to a very acrimonious end to lame duck? Or perhaps is there a piece of legislation out there which someone is getting ready to uncork that we might have at least heard some rumblings about at this point that could make for some late nights ahead before lawmakers call it a year?
Well, I think the scenario on that, if there is going to be something like that, it would mean that roads probably collapses, a road deal collapses, because to get a roads package through the legislature almost certainly is going to involve needing a lot of Democratic votes. And the Democratic leader in the House, Tim Grimmel, has made it clear he wants roads to be the last thing that is done, because if, say, the House Democrats vote to pass a road funding package, let's just say next week, for argument's sake, that it happens next week, and that leaves one more week of session, that they are very worried then they have lost all leverage and that some of the issues they are very worried about could then get passed with only Republican votes. So those are things like repealing the prevailing wage law in Michigan or changing how Michigan awards electoral votes in the presidential election. If Rhodes falls apart, then the Republicans may say, well, we don't need the Democrats for anything now. Let's do some of these things.
Zach Gorchow, as always, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Gordon.
Zach Gorchow is the editor of the Gongwer News Service. Links with more information and longer versions of interviews on West Southwest can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.